Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's get right to it with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the great things in the wonderful world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from the Washington Post, Trump has kept this controversial pesticide on the market. Now its biggest manufacturer is stopping production. The main manufacturer of a pesticide used for decades on a wide variety of crops, including strawberries, corn, and citrus, said it will stop making the product, which some scientists have said is linked to neurological problems in children. The announcement came the same day that California, a leading agricultural state, made it illegal to sell chlorpyrifos. It is one of the growing number of states that has moved to block the pesticide from the market. The announcement marks a victory for public health and environmental advocates who have fought for years to ban chlorpyrifos, saying the compound poses unwarranted health risks, particularly to farm workers and children. But activists said the fight would continue given that other companies still produce the pesticide and the federal government has allowed it to remain on the market. We definitely see this as a win, Marissa Ordonia, a senior associate attorney for Earth Justice, an environmental group that has sued in federal court seeking to force the U.S. government to ban chlorpyrifos. But we are still in the fight for the full ban so that children and farm workers will no longer be exposed to it. In California, state health officials said their decision to ban chlorpyrifos came amid increasing scientific evidence that the pesticide causes serious health effects in children and other sensitive populations at lower levels of exposure than previously understood. At the time, California Governor Gavin Newsom also proposed $5.7 million to support the transition to safer, more sustainable alternatives, according to the California Environmental Protection Agency. Removing chlorpyrifos from the toolbox of chemical agribusiness in California is the kind of aggressive action elected leaders must take to safeguard public health, Ken Cook, president of the Environmental Working Group, an activist group, said in a statement. Farm workers, children, and other Californians will no longer be exposed to a dangerous chemical that can permanently impair the brain and nervous systems. If only President Trump's EPA had listened to its own scientists and not blocked a federal ban of chlorpyrifos, millions of other kids would enjoy the same protections. Okay, next up, very interesting article from the Columbus Dispatch. Survey, nearly two-thirds of adults report feeling lonely. Social isolation is on the rise in the United States, and people who are socially isolated have a 29% increased risk of mortality, according to studies. It is also linked to depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and suicidal thoughts. Americans are feeling increasingly isolated, and healthcare officials are warning that can lead to an increased risk of death. 3 in 5, or 61%, of adult U.S. workers report being lonely, up more than fivefold from 2018, according to Cigna's recently released 2020 Loneliness Index. The health insurer found the spike in loneliness in surveying more than 10,000 adult workers in July and August of 2019. Work conditions play a big role, according to the annual survey. The trend shaping how we work, increasing use of technology, more telecommuting, and always on work culture are leaving Americans more stressed, less rested, spending more time on social media, and less time with friends and family, David Cordani, Cygnus president and CEO, said in a statement. Experts say the trend is disturbing because loneliness and social isolation have been estimated to shorten a person's life by 15 years, equivalent in impact to being obese or smoking 15 cigarettes per day. The increase in people feeling isolated comes amid a rising mental health crisis in America, which is leading to burnout in the workplace, said Sarah Conrath, an associate professor of philanthropic studies at Indiana University, Purdue University. People are pushing themselves so hard when it comes to work-related topics, and what this does is push away our time for relaxing, Conrath said. Not just watching Netflix, but hanging out with people. This is stuff we know from research that is really good for our bodies. People often use social isolation and loneliness interchangeably, but they differ, experts say. Social isolation is the objective physical separation from other people, such as living alone, while loneliness is the subjective distressed feeling of being alone or separated, according to the National Institute of Aging. You could be in a room of 100 people and still feel very lonely. Social isolation can lead to a slew of health problems, including high blood pressure, heart disease, obesity, a weakened immune system, and even death. It has also been linked to anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and suicidal thoughts, said Marilyn Sampilo, a licensed psychologist at the Center for Behavioral Health at the Cleveland Clinic. While living alone does not inevitably lead to social isolation, it can be a contributing factor. The number of people living alone in the U.S. jumped from 13% in 1950 to 28% in 2019. Social media can have an impact on loneliness and social isolation. Smartphones and social media can help people feel connected. Yes, it's not as satisfying just to connect for a minute online compared to healthy, positive face-to-face interactions. Negative experiences on social media are linked to more feelings of social isolation, according to a new study by the University of Pittsburgh Center for Research on Media Technology and Health. The study found that for every 10% increase in negative interactions on social media, study participants were 13% more likely to feel lonely. And social isolation affects people of all ages. For youths, social isolation can lead to behavioral problems and poor social skills, and missing lots of school can lead to social isolation. Adults who are going through a transitional period, such as moving to a new city, starting a new job, or graduating college, are more likely to experience social isolation. Coworkers are generally the most effective way to make friends and have people to hang out with outside of work, so losing that as an avenue of making friends is a little difficult. I think this is actually a very striking study, particularly with the sharp increase in loneliness reported. Again, remembering that loneliness is a subjective experience, not necessarily associated simply with physical isolation. And linking this up to the workplace, obviously we're becoming more kind of a virtual reality, this on all the time. And also it seems to be degrading apparently significantly, substantially, meaningfully in our social connectedness with other people, with more deeper, less superficial interactions with the human beings, getting support or just hanging out, quote, being with other people is good for our health. One of my big concerns, if you're looking at like the social indicators or social determinants of health, I would actually put it under something I would call alienation, which would be closely related to this. And I think this relates to a lot of things, but this article definitely gets at it. And with increasing alienation, you're going to see a host of poor health outcomes. So try to connect with friends today. Okay, next up from ift.org. This is a long article about what, when, and where America eats. I pared it way down a bunch of statistics. I've kind of just highlighted a few of the interesting ones. So here we go. Americans are spending more than half, 54% of their food dollars, on food away from home. That's the highest level in history. Although more than 8 in 10 dinners are eaten at home, the number of evening meals prepared at home continues to fall. 13,000 new UPC food beverage brands were launched in 2018. Oh my goodness. 13,000 new brands. Diners ordered 6.4 billion beef burgers and 4 billion chicken sandwiches versus 228 million vegetable burgers and vegetable salad sandwiches in year ending April 2019. So, looks like still way under 10% of our, let me see, what is that, 228 million over about 10 billion. So, yeah, not very many are actually vegetable-based. A lot of burgers and chicken sandwiches. But consumers are not dining out more often. Diners eat at the restaurant on only 38% of all visits. 39% of visits are for carryout, 22% are drive-through visits, and 3% involve food delivery. Over the past 2 years, 14% of adults say they have increased their frequency of eating meatless meals. 14% describe themselves as flexitarian, and 4% say they are pescatarian. That's people that will only eat flesh, that is, fish. While 32% of consumers are interested in vegetarian menu items and 28% are interested in vegan menu items, the percentage who are practicing these eating plans is a much smaller group. 5% of consumers define themselves as full-time vegetarians, and 3% say they are full-time vegans. Vegan descriptors appear in 11% of restaurant menus. One-third of consumers purchase a meat alternative in a recent three-month period. Three-quarters of those who buy meat alternatives also eat meat. 4 in 10 consumers, 43%, purchase milk alternatives in a recent three-month period. 30% bought dairy product alternatives. 4 in 10 consumers eat fresh produce daily. 36% eat fresh fruits or vegetables 3 days a week or less often. Nearly half, 47% of adults, eat more than 3 snacks per day. Two-thirds snack in the afternoon, 57% in the evening, 40% in the late evening, 36% at mid-morning, and 26% in the early morning. Nearly half of consumers say their diet could be somewhat healthier. 23% say it could be a lot healthier. 4 in 10 closely monitor what they eat. 43% try to eat healthy but don't pay close attention. And 9% claim to be on a strict diet. Although nearly 6 in 10 consumers say they're eating more plant-based foods than 2 years ago, consumption of fruits and vegetables and meat have not changed accordingly. And a sort of related one here, another fact, which is a little bit different than what was in the previous one. Do consumers care about what's in fake meat? This interesting little fact showed up from the International Food Information Council survey, where they found that most people, 66%, are omnivores. 23% claim to restrict their consumption of animal meat in some way. 5% were vegan, 6% were vegetarian, 8% were sometimes vegetarian, and 5% were pescatarian. Okay, sticking with the food theme, this from foodpolitics.com. According to Morning Consult's first annual State of Brand Trust Report, more than half of Americans say they have little or no trust in corporate America. 54% of consumers say they have little or no trust in corporations, while only 28% hold the same for food and beverage industry corporations. Okay, no lack of trust there. Okay, this from Stat News, more on the coronavirus. Health experts warn China travel ban will hinder coronavirus response. The Trump administration's decision to ban most foreign nationals who had been into China in the last 2 weeks from traveling to the United States amid an accelerating outbreak of a novel coronavirus, there was preceded by calls for similar policies from conservative lawmakers and far-right supporters of the president. Public health experts, however, warn that the move could do more harm than good. The administration's public health emergency declaration also requires U.S. citizens returning from China to undergo some level of quarantine, depending on where they had been in China. The ban comes on top of moves by major U.S. airlines halting flights to and from mainland China. The outbreak has sickened nearly 10,000 people, mostly in China, and killed more than 200. Actually, update that to, we're cracking, I think, 800 now. Going up fast. A few countries have responded by imposing full or limited travel bans. The Philippines, for instance, has banned travel from the city of Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak. Countries including the Bahamas, Mongolia, and Singapore have banned all travel from China. Public health experts have warned that travel bans are not effective at stemming the spread of a virus and can make responding to an outbreak more challenging. From a public health perspective, there is limited effectiveness. And then there are a host of other reasons why they can actually be counterproductive, said Catherine Warsnop, who studies international cooperation during global health emergencies at the University of Maryland. The World Health Organization, which declared the outbreak a global health emergency, has recommended against any travel or trade restrictions in response to the outbreak. Member countries, however, do not have to comply with that guidance. Although travel restrictions may intuitively seem like the right thing to do, this is not something the World Health Organization usually recommends, said Tarek Jasarevic, a World Health Organization spokesperson. This is because of the social disruption they cause and the intensive use of resources required, he added. Experts said travel bans could lead to a slew of downstream effects and risk complicating the public health response. There's not only the financial toll in a country that is dealing with this outbreak, but this can discourage transparency, both in this outbreak and in the future. Travel and trade restrictions can lead to dire economic consequences for countries involved, creating a disincentive for them to quickly disclose potential outbreaks to the World Health Organization or other nations. They can hinder the sharing of information, making it harder to track cases and their contacts, and disrupt the medical supply chain, potentially fueling shortages of drugs and medical supplies in the areas hit hardest by the outbreak. They also send a punitive message, which could contribute to discrimination and stigmatization against Chinese nationals, experts warned. Any effort and money spent crafting and enforcing travel and trade restrictions also take away already stretched resources from public health measures that have been proven to be far more effective. Those measures include providing assistance to countries with weaker health systems, accelerating the development of a vaccine or rapid diagnostic test, and clear communicating with the public about when and how to seek care. But for politicians, those responses might not feel as tangible in action as enacting a travel ban. During the 2013-2014 Ebola outbreak, there was a flurry of calls for a U.S. ban on travel from the affected countries, including from Donald Trump, then a private citizen. People want their government to do something when these outbreaks are happening, and adopting a border restriction is a visible policy that people think works. Enacting such a ban would go directly against the recommendations of the World Health Organization, which has said countries must inform the organization of any travel restrictions they put in place. Adopting these restrictions undermines the cooperative approach we need to respond to this kind of outbreak, specifically by undermining the authority of the World Health Organization, which has recommended against these restrictions. Warsnop said she is hopeful that the World Health Organization will be able to hold countries accountable for disregarding its guidance, including pressing countries for scientific justification for their travel policies and calling out governments that have gone against its recommendations. Unfortunately, governments face domestic and international pressures and have faced few costs in the past for not following World Health Organization recommendations. Well, this is a good example, I would say, particularly at this moment in time in world history, where you have a real contrast of a public health approach, which requires cooperation between nations and peoples and communities, versus kind of this law enforcement approach, which is very punitive and punishing, which in this case actually is probably counterproductive. And sticking with that theme of a law enforcement approach, going to hit a switch gears a little bit. And this is an investigative journalist article from ProPublica, how these jail officials profit from selling e-cigarettes to inmates. A very good example of how our prison industrial complex profits off people and harms the public health. Okay, here we go. A Kentucky river city, once rich in tobacco, was grappling with growing concerns about the health risks of electronic cigarettes. The former governor had already banned e-cigarettes in some state buildings, and lawmakers had prohibited selling them to anyone younger than 18. So, in May 2017, city leaders in Henderson decided to add vaping to a more than decade-old ban on smoking in local government buildings and other public places. This prohibition meant a loss of revenue for the Henderson County Detention Center, which purchased e-cigarettes and then resold them to inmates at triple or quadruple the wholesale price. It also threatened a steady stream of business for the jail's supplier, Crossbar Electronic Cigarettes. That posed a problem for Jamie Mosley, a jailer across the state who runs a Laurel County Correctional Center. Mosley invented the e-cigarettes sold at this jail, and his wife, Christy Mosley, is listed in state records as an owner of the company. Less than 2 months after the ban was enacted, Mosley drove 250 miles to the western Kentucky city along the Ohio River to join the county jailers in seeking an exemption for the jail. Mosley said e-cigarettes he developed were safer than competing products because they couldn't be fashioned into weapons. He also used his jail as an example, saying e-cigarettes improved morale and curbed fighting. In the end, the Henderson jail was allowed to keep the revenue driver, which brought nearly $150,000 in profits the previous year, and Crossbar remained its e-cigarette supplier. Mosley is one of at least four elected Kentucky jailers who have capitalized on the e-cigarette boom, either by forming companies that sell vaping products to inmates in other jails or by handling lucrative businesses in their own facilities to friends and family, the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting and ProPublica have found. He and other jailers have also successfully fought the few proposed health measures that would have put such businesses in peril. The stakes are high for Crossbar. A 2018 article from Vice News, which featured Mosley, estimated that the company would make $3.5 million in e-cigarette sales that year. Mosley declined to confirm the figures or give updated sales numbers, but records provided by 12 Kentucky jails show more than $356,000 in payments to the company in 2018. Many cash-strapped jails prop up their budgets by purchasing e-cigarettes from suppliers and reselling them to inmates. Those e-cigarette sales brought in more than $1.3 million in 2018 to nearly two-thirds of the state's jails, according to data shared with ProPublica in response to requests under the State Open Records Act. The remaining third didn't provide information. Seven jails reported netting more than $100,000 apiece. Profits from e-cigarettes often outweigh health concerns for thousands of inmates in Kentucky, even when jailers, their friends, and their families don't personally benefit. Ellen Hahn, director of the University of Kentucky Center for Smoke-Free Policy and a professor of nursing, said jails should be helping to wean inmates off nicotine, not selling products that push them further into addiction. Okay, in both sticking with the same thing and switching a little bit gears, this from the Environmental Health Network, the disturbing link between environmental racism and criminalization. The United States of America has the largest prison system of any nation on earth, the largest number of prisoners of any country, and one of the highest percentages of imprisoned persons of any nation. As of this writing, there are more than 2 million people incarcerated in federal and state prisons, jails, immigration prisons, and other, quote, correctional facilities in the United States. If all of those prisoners were housed in one location, it would constitute the fourth largest city in the nation. While scholars have established that prisons and imprisonment show few signs of abatement in the U.S. and are sites of racialized and gendered violence, an emergent area of research that I work on reveals that the prison system is also a space where incarcerated persons and their allies struggle for environmental justice, a vision of change that views ecological sustainability as inseparable from social equity and democracy. These battles are taking place because prisons and jails in the U.S. are institutions where people of color are overrepresented and are frequently built adjacent to or even on top of toxic waste sites, are inundated with air and or water contamination, and are sources of hazardous waste generation. One question this research has raised, how might these challenges be recast if we consider the phenomenon of environmental justice as a form of criminalization? In other words, since environmental injustice is frequently a process and product of state-sanctioned institutional violence against communities of color in the form of polluted air, land, water, and human bodies, then what are the implications of reframing it as a practice of treating these populations as inherently criminal and deserving of punishment? Moreover, how are the targets and survivors of environmental injustice and racism enlisted in ways that resist criminalization and support a positive vision of change. I am exploring these questions through a consideration of how struggles inside and outside of prisons represent urgent and timely opportunities to rethink the possibilities of environmental justice and the problem of incarceration. Environmental injustice harms incarcerated persons as well as their families and ecosystems within, around, and beyond the prison's walls. This occurs through both exposures to environmental threats and through the broader ways that harsh inequalities are produced across many social institutions in this nation, for example, housing, education, healthcare, etc., that intersect with the prison system and structure domination, constrained behaviors and freedoms, and that intensely criminalize certain populations. This means that expanding upon earlier environmental justice study approaches that tend to frame harmful environmental exposures in one-dimensional terms, prisons represent a way of understanding how particular bodies and communities can suffer the brutality of environmental racism as criminalization from birth through death, from living in toxic homes and residential communities that are also occupied by police forces, to attending schools that are inundated with toxins and occupied by police, to employment in toxic industries where workers are also routinely surveilled and disciplined, to incarceration in toxic prisons where criminalization and surveillance come with the territory. This perspective reflects geographer Catherine McKittrick's concept of prison life, which points to the everyday workings of incarceration as they are necessarily lived and experienced as a form of human life and struggle inside and outside prisons. The links between environmental racism and criminalization are palpable when we consider current U.S. immigration policy, which routinely brings the full force of institutional violence against migrants and refugees. My research team found that there are numerous immigrant prisons located in sites that are plagued with extremely hazardous chemicals in the ambient air, land, and in-water tables. Chemicals that are known to be associated with developmental disorders, neurological damage, respiratory illness, and cancer. These findings are of great concern to immigrant justice advocates because many children who have been separated from their families and parents by the government are imprisoned at many of these facilities. As is the case at many immigration prisons around the nation, detainees routinely resist these harsh conditions through hunger strikes, sit-ins, and other means of protest and defiance against this brutal system. In 2015, mothers imprisoned at the Karnes County Civil Detention Facility in Texas went on a hunger strike, and one of their grievances was that the tap water was foul-tasting because it had been heavily chlorinated, most likely in an effort to disinfect any pathogens or toxins related to the nearby heavy industrial fracking operations. The mothers had been purchasing clean water at the prison commissary to maintain their health, but the authorities shut down the store, thus forcing them to drink the water they suspected was contaminated. This action was one of many institutional decisions the prisoners were resisting in order to achieve some semblance of health and justice. The connections between criminalization, climate injustice, and environmental injustice collide violently at State Correctional Institution Fayette in LaBelle, Pennsylvania, a majority black and brown town, where prisoners, who are overwhelmingly working class and people of color, are forced to endure life next to coal ash dump containing an estimated 40 million tons of coal waste and two coal slurry ponds. The Abolitionist Law Center and Human Rights Coalition undertook a year-long investigation of the health consequences of this exposure and revealed that an unusually high percentage of prisoners report declining health and symptoms and illness consistent with exposure to toxic coal waste, including cancer, respiratory, throat, and sinus conditions, thyroid disorders, blurred vision, fatigue, hair loss, dizziness, headaches, gastrointestinal problems, and much more. Moreover, residents of the nearby town of LaBelle suffer from the exact same health conditions. One inmate, Nicholas Morrissey, told investigators, "I can't even control my body anymore. My life has been completely changed in the last year. I went from an athletic and healthy person to a frail, sickly man who can barely walk." Richard Mosley is an African-American man who did time at the Fayette facility. And when he began experiencing illness symptoms and received no satisfactory response from prison officials, he took action by filing a lawsuit against the prison. Mosley was eventually released, having served his sentence. Soon after his departure from prison, he joined an organization whose goal was to shine a light on the injustices at the Fayette facility and to seek real change. In a grassroots newsletter published in 2018, Mosley articulates his group's aims. We, the Fayette Justice Health Community of Put People First, Pennsylvania, are determined and steadfast in seeking justice for those who have been affected and are currently being affected by health and environmental hazards at this Fayette facility in and near LaBelle, Pennsylvania. These cases reveal how states and other powerful institutions expand the practice of criminalizing populations by locking up people and by deeming them unfit to breathe clean air, unworthy of drinking clean water, and undeserving of living in structures that sit atop clean soil. These institutional phenomena signal that criminalization is frequently amplified and given greater force and impact through environmentally unjust practices. No less disturbing is that the targeted poisoning and polluting of people behind bars reflects what has long been a practice of doing the same to, quote, free residential communities, suggesting that environmental racism and criminalization intersect and reinforce one another on both sides of the prison walls. Fortunately, prisoners and their allies are challenging these brutalities through a dynamic environmental justice movement that is producing a vision of environmental sustainability that is linked with ending mass incarceration. Well, more power to them. Okay, well, sticking to the theme of not having control over one's body, this from the World Health Organization. Female genital mutilation hurts women and economies. Female genital mutilation exacts a crippling economic as well as human cost, according to the World Health Organization. Female genital mutilation is not only a catastrophic abuse of human rights that significantly harms the physical and mental health of millions of girls and women, it is also a drain on the country's vital economic resources, said Dr. Ian Askew, director of the World Health Organization's Department of Sexual and Reproductive Health and Research. More investment is urgently needed to stop female genital mutilation and end the suffering it inflicts. New modeling reveals that the total cost of treating the health effects of female genital mutilation would amount to $1.4 billion globally per year if all resulting medical needs were addressed. For individual countries, these costs could near 10% of the entire yearly expenditures on health on average. In some countries, this figure rises to as much as 30%. The interactive modeling tool that generated these data was launched on the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. Women and girls living with female genital mutilation face serious risks to their health and well-being. These include immediate consequences after being cut, such as infections, bleeding or psychological trauma, as well as chronic health conditions that can occur throughout life. Women who have undergone the procedure are more likely to experience life-threatening complications during childbirth. They may face mental health disorders or suffer chronic infections. They may also have pain or problems when they menstruate, urinate, or have sexual intercourse. All of these conditions warrant much-needed medical attention and care. High healthcare costs for countries mount because of the tragic personal impacts on women and girls. Governments have a moral responsibility to help end this harmful practice, says Dr. Prosper Tumasiami, acting director of Universal Health Coverage and the Life Course in the Africa Regional Office of the World Health Organization. Female genital mutilation hurts girls, imposes lifelong health risks on the women they become, and strains the healthcare systems that need to treat them. Female genital mutilation is internationally recognized as a human rights violation. It has no medical benefits and causes only harm. The World Health Organization's position is that female genital mutilation must never be carried out.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice. Well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you would like to review this show, queue up past shows or future shows, feel free to go to toppun.com/blog/wakt.